Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Our guest today is Susan Bielstein, Executive Editor for Art, Architecture, Classical Studies, and Film at the University of Chicago Press, who's here to talk with us about her recent book entitled Permissions, a Survival Guide, Blunt Talk About Art as Intellectual Property, published last year by the University of Chicago Press. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Tom.
We have had discussions on the Library Cafe in the past about what's often called a crisis in academic book publishing, precipitated by a vicious circle of spiraling costs and diminishing markets that ultimately results in scholarly presses selling fewer titles at prices that even institutional budgets, let alone individual scholars and students, can afford to pay. And this is especially the case for art books, which I can attest to personally as an art librarian. Certainly, there's been a great deal of concern expressed by scholars in art history about the academic art publishing situation. A Mellon-funded report by the art historians Hilary Ballin and Mariette Westerman, published this January on the state of art historical publishing, indicated that academic publishers are shrinking or refocusing their arts runs on crossover books or ceasing to publish art books altogether, and that young scholars are increasingly finding it impossible to find venues for their manuscripts. So before we go on to talk about the problem of permissions, can you talk a bit about this larger picture in scholarly monograph publishing from a publisher's perspective?
Oh, yes, I can. You know, academic publishing is, in fact, in part about service to the academy, but it's also a business, and it's about disseminating scholarship into a viable marketplace. You mentioned that every year you buy fewer books, and that's part of the problem for us. I want to talk a little bit about the various markets for academic books. And I mean, you know better than I how library budgets have been pared to the bone for books,
Yeah. And
more investment is being made in electronic products. University presses used to count on libraries as their primary market. We used to be able to sell 1,000 copies of a book to libraries, and now we can only count on selling a couple of hundred. Similarly, the fact that the used book market has organized itself so beautifully on the internet means that, you know, the productive sales life of a new book is really less than 3 years. And finally, I'd say that the preponderance of course packs and e-packs has virtually killed the student market for secondary text. You know, when authors ask me why their book isn't selling these days, what I can usually do is respond brightly by saying that, well, maybe the book isn't selling, but chapter 3 is selling very well.
Yeah.
And all of this obviously has created a tremendously challenging environment for nonprofit scholarly publishers.
Yeah. This is particularly hard on new people in the field because the numbers of new PhDs in art history are increasing dramatically in comparison with other disciplines. And schools are hiring art historians, but it's difficult for them to get published. So it's not as though there's not a need for art historical publishing.
Well, you know, we rely on the academy to support its presses. I think one of the things that has happened is that art history and other disciplines in the humanity have come to understand, well, I mean, publishers have been crying like Cassandra about this for many, many years, but they've finally come to understand that the academy can no longer count on university presses, nor should they ever have counted on university presses to be part of the tenure credentialing process. That is, meaning that I, a university editor who receives well over 1,000 proposals for books a year and can only publish 20 of them, that I should be, in my limited fashion, the gatekeeper for whether or not someone on their faculty has published a viable piece of scholarship. They're learning that they need to take that function back. And, you know, one of the wonderful things about the internet now is that university presses can only afford to publish a few books based on dissertations.
Yeah.
Now it's becoming increasingly much easier to disseminate those kinds of writing projects via the internet.
Electronically, yeah. We had an interesting discussion a few months ago with Chuck Henry when he was at Rice University Press, which he has just revived as an electronic-only university press in order to do exactly what you say there.
Ironically, I ran that press before it went electronic.
Oh, yeah. No, oh.
I ran it, I won't say into the ground, but, you know, but anyway.
So, well, should universities be doing more to help in the cost of the publication in terms of academic presses? I mean, should there be more cooperation these days between university presses and their namesake?
Yes, I think so. If you mean should universities provide greater subsidies to support their university presses.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, no matter how much money a university gives to a press, it won't be enough to support really a very expensive enterprise.
Yeah.
Invariably, even for presses that do receive subsidies, all presses rely on book sales or journal sales and on gifts and grants to keep the light on. And
yeah.
From my perspective, in a way, isn't that as it should be? I mean, what's the point of publishing work that no one wants to read?
Well, that's true, too. The problem in art publishing isn't just confined to the academic presses. In an article that appeared in September's Art in America, entitled The Art Book's Last Stand, the executive editor of Prestel Art Books, Christopher Lyons, lamented the demise of the large format commercial art book, which had its heyday during the last half of the 20th century, and which used to serve the important function of bridging the gap between the core audiences for books about art and the general reader. And Lyons starts that article rather dejectedly talking about the new bookstore of the recently renovated Museum of Modern Art, where the books one sees in the shop through the windows from the outside of the museum turn out to be a printed facade when one enters the shop, since only about 15% of the store's floor space is now actually devoted to books. The rest is jewelry and other museum merchandise. So for various reasons, this venue's also dried up for the serious scholar wishing to publish an art monograph, since the market has been so diminished and dumbed down that really only a work with broad public appeal has any chance of getting published at all.
You know, I understand where Chris is coming from. We've had a lot of talks about the status of the old art book in the tradition of Abrams. But if you really look closely at some of the commercial publishers like Fiden and Toshin,
Thames and Hudson.
Yeah, they do a lot of lifestyle books and such, the kind that Chris is decrying. But on the other hand, if you look closely at their list, they also do some big, ambitious books.
Yeah.
They still continue to, not perhaps as their core business, but Toshin has done some very important books.
Yeah, and Prestel, I notice, still sometimes. So.
And Prestel does. It's just a different world, and we can moan about the past all we want, but mostly we need to start thinking about how to work creatively within the current environment.
Yeah, interestingly here, it isn't as if there isn't still a potential market for art books among the general public, is it? I mean, we're constantly being reminded that we live in a visual culture.
Oh, yes. And in fact, I should mention, too, that university presses also do books of broader appeal when it comes to visual culture.
Yeah.
Probably not, as one would say, truly dumbed down, but works that we hope are, to some extent, captivating, that will contribute some sort of critical thinking to the broader culture. And even though we've talked a little bit about the sort of hemorrhaging of the market for art books, well, yes, it's still in crisis, but publishing is always cyclical. And, you know, about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a terrible crisis in art publishing when publishers finally started to realize how their markets were diminishing. And, you know, a number of presses, well, Cambridge pretty much eliminated its publishing program for serious art history books, for art history books at all. And Princeton went through a crisis, and California cut back in its program, though it didn't eliminate it. And yet, I think if you really start looking at who's doing what now, I think we're on an upswing.
Oh, good.
For example, here at Chicago, I used to do 12 to 15 visual culture books a year, and now I'm doing about 24.
Yeah, well, of course, it's not just art historians who need images to make an argument anymore, is it? As all the fields are becoming more visually oriented, really, across the humanities.
Absolutely. It's interesting. Literary critics have really moved over and started populating the fields of visual culture and even art studies, and they use visual images more than ever. So do historians of science.
Yeah.
And just about every field, as you've indicated.
Yeah. And museum publishing seems to be relatively safe, doesn't it? I mean, institutions certainly are still putting out very nice exhibition catalogs for their major shows.
Oh, yes. Of course, those are heavily subsidized.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
They have big subsidies usually from donors or corporate sponsors.
Yeah.
But even they, I mean, they have to struggle in the ways that many of us do, including the issue of getting permissions to publish the images in those books, even when they own the underlying artwork itself.
Yeah. And then that's what we're going going to move on to talk about, since that's the subject of your book, the whole question of permissions. Both of the articles that I mentioned point to the problem of the rise of reproduction rights costs, and perhaps just as significant, the difficulty of securing these rights as a critical factor in the art book crisis. And I noticed that both Christopher Lyons and yourself characterize the situation in similar terms. Lyons talks about permissions purgatory, and you talk about the chamber of horrors behind the blue door at the end of the hall in the museum or library basement that constitutes the rights office. Your book, I should say, is very colorful and funny in the way you talk about permissions problems, because it is, for anyone that has to deal with permissions, a sort of absurdist world, isn't it?
If you don't laugh, you're going to cry.
You're going to cry, yeah.
Or scream.
In fact, your book has a sort of Dante-esque feeling about it in places, as you lead the reader through the wilderness of torments awaiting anyone foolish enough to want to publish a book illustrated with artworks. So can you talk about the kinds of rights one must secure in order to publish an image in a book, or say, an internet publication?
Well, yeah, there are basically two kinds of rights, and you may or may not need one or both to publish an image. First of all, you need to know if the image you want to publish, and it doesn't matter if it's in books or online, whether the work is in copyright.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean the work is protected, and that the right to allow that work to be published redounds to its creator, mm-hmm. or a creator's agent. So that's the first thing. I mean, for example, a painting by Jasper Johns. The copyright is held by Jasper Johns.
Yeah.
And except for very specific circumstances, you will need Mr. Johns' permission to publish that image. The second kind of permission that can be involved is sometimes you need permission just to get your hands on,
mm-hmm.
or your computer get its electronic hands on an image that you want to publish, that you can actually use. So a use permission, when someone gives you an image,
mm-hmm.
for example, a photo bank that sells images of artworks, a museum that owns an artwork and has copied it to disseminate for publication or to license for publication, when they send you that, in my opinion, the minute they send you that and agree to let you publish it, they're giving you permission to use it. Now, sometimes they exercise a copyright-like authority,
yeah.
over those images, which I think is a very controversial practice,
yeah.
because they're implying that they have a copyright right,
yeah.
in a work for which they actually may not.
Can you talk in very general terms about the purpose of copyright law in terms of the kinds of rights it is supposed to balance?
Yeah, the whole idea behind copyright has for centuries been to balance the rights of an individual author or creator or artist against the needs of a larger public. This is how modern culture has been created. Essentially, what copyright law says is that any creative work that can be fixed in a tangible medium qualifies for copyright protection.
Yeah.
And this gives its creator the right to determine if and when and how a work can be used. They might give one person the right to publish a drawing that they've done. They might give another person the right to use that drawing in a motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
The great thing about copyright law, as it was originally conceived, was that these rights would be held by the creator or the creator's heirs,
mm-hmm.
for a limited period of time.
Yeah.
And after a certain period of time, that creative work would go into the public domain, into the broader culture, that it would become part of our commonwealth and available for anyone to use or capitalize on as we choose.
So it spurs creation on two fronts, really, in that it gives the artist some incentive to create something and get remunerated for it, but on the other hand, eventually, it allows artists farther down the line to use the original work in their own art, the way, say, Disney does with the Brothers Grimm with Cinderella and Snow White.
Right, they're, yeah. adapted or derivative works is,
yeah.
what those are called.
So have recent revisions in the law thrown this balance out of whack?
Well,
it's a big question, I know, but I'm thinking especially of the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act, which really adds on to the duration.
Well, exactly. I mean, let me explain that I believe in copyright,
yeah.
law, and I think that a writer or artist deserves to be paid,
mm-hmm.
for what they do if somebody else is interested in it, in having it copied. But it is true that the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act, which was heavily supported by the entertainment industry, outfits like Disney and Time Warner, added an extra 20 years to the copyright life of a work of art. It basically now is that a work is in copyright for the lifetime of an author plus 70 years. So you're not just, you know, providing a little extra cash for the widow and orphans. You may very well be providing a great deal of income for great nephews.
Or corporate entities.
Yeah. I mean, the copyright term of life plus 50 was already pretty long.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's true that the Bono has exacerbated the situation, yeah. I think.
Interestingly, patent law hasn't followed the same lines. I mean, it's still a fairly short duration that you can keep a work under patent.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And that is because patent law is terrific because it requires cultural producers mm-hmm. and inventors to constantly be productive. You know, it not only creates a better world, say, through works, drugs going out of patent, becoming generic after a while, but it forces creative people to keep working and keep producing.
So can you talk about the work of art in this context, since copyright, after all, was originally concerned exclusively with printed text, not a created object as a work in itself or captured in a photograph. So how does the work of art itself become protected?
Well, that is a very interesting question, and it's one of the key things I take up in my book. You know, copyright law has, over the centuries, always enlarged its purview to stay in pace with new inventions and new technologies and media. For example, you didn't see photography mentioned in intellectual property case law or in statutes until the mid-1800s, when they began to realize that this was a viable way of creating copies. Now, about fine art, similarly, apart from graphics, copyright protections for, say, paintings was not a big deal until the technology was perfected around the turn of the 20th century that could produce a reasonably accurate copy of something. But you're right, it is styled for text.
Uh-huh.
For example, one was not able to even register a work of art, a unique work of art, say a painting or a singular sculpture, something like that, with the U.S. Copyright Office until the 1950s. Before that, it was pretty much flying blind. It was very, very difficult. There were no special accommodations for works of art.
So does this mean that as complex as our dueling copyright laws are for someone trying to determine the status of a textual work, that the rules governing the status of an art reproduction are even more complicated?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's much, much less of a documentary trail regarding works of art than texts.
And then apart from the written law, which between the Sonny Bono Act and the 1976 Act don't always seem to be entirely consistent, there's a lot of case law on copyright, and this doesn't seem to be entirely consistent either, does it?
Oh, no. I mean, the case law, which in some ways is the most important part of copyright law, I think. I mean, the statutes define things in very broad terms, but it's, you know, it's really what happens on the ground with gatekeepers like myself and also the courts that, you know, the really robust law takes place. And yes, so, I mean, you are invariably left to the decision of a jury or a judge who will have an independent and individualistic interpretation of the law.
Yeah, and this can actually cause a sort of chilling in terms of creative work. And I'm thinking, you mentioned the case of Robert Rauschenberg.
Well, yes, and I think Rauschenberg, as did many of the first appropriation artists around mid-century, Warhol, Rauschenberg, various others, all came up against copyright issues when they appropriated others' works. But I think Jeff Koons, which was an actual legal case, the case of String of Puppies, is the most telling when it comes to a chilling effect.
And then also, I suppose, making things even more complicated is the fact that you have to deal with the copyright laws of other countries.
No country is required to protect the work of an artist longer than we protect that of our own. Now, sometimes we do that, but the situation is this, and this has become a very crucial issue since the world has gone global and since we can now disseminate information with the click of a mouse. We can send it all over the world. And so it's true. I mean, what might be perfectly acceptable in the United States, for example, it would be perfectly acceptable for me to publish a picture I took of the Hermitage Museum in Russia in the United States. But in Russia, that work is considered protected as national cultural property, and the government wants you to ask their permission to publish it in their country.
So would you have a difficult time distributing a book published in this country to the Russians if you didn't take their statutes into consideration?
Yes, this can be an issue.
What about the photograph or slide of the work you presumably use in transferring it into a print form or online? Are photographs of artworks considered protected also, as though the photographer were a creator, even if he's just taking, or she, a photograph of a painting in a museum?
Well, this is an area of huge concern. In fact, it is probably at the core of my book. It may sound trivial, but in fact, it sort of tests the whole basis of what copyright is entirely. Copyright is based on protecting works that are original, that contain a spark of originality. And it doesn't have to be a huge spark, but there has to be originality.
Yeah.
Now, there are a lot of photographs, as you've mentioned. In fact, most photographs that we use in art publications are made from slides,
yeah,
copy photos, digital copies, slavish images, these are called. I mean, it may require a lot of skill to produce one of these images, but their intent is to copy precisely the underlying work of art. In fact, the more slavishly they copy it, the,
yeah,
better they are. The problem with putting a copyright claim on these kinds of slavish images is that it really challenges the whole basis of copyright altogether. For example, if you say that the gesture of copying another work is itself an original act and therefore copyrightable, then what's to prevent me coming along, copying your work,
yeah,
and putting my copyright,
yeah,
on that one?
Yeah.
So the whole idea of what qualifies for copyright kind of collapses,
yeah,
under that regime. And it's a big struggle. There's some case law around this issue, and there needs to be a lot more, I think.
Well, not everybody seems to take the view that straight-up photographic reproductions of paintings and drawings, not to mention sculpture, are not subject to copyright. And a lot of collectors and institutions, including many art museums, use this as a way to exert copyright control over works that have long been in the public domain.
Right.
And is this why so many museums prohibit visitors, then, from photographing works in their collections, especially if you come armed with a tripod?
The tripod.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's not a simple yes or no.
Yeah.
I do know that the whole business about the tripod and the flash, some of it is based on protecting the work,
yeah,
of art.
Ostensibly.
And the whole notion of the tripod is based on protecting visitors to the museum.
Yeah.
People trip over them,
yeah,
that sort of thing. But, in fact, very often tripods are seen to signal a serious photographer,
yeah,
you know, who's going to make a commercially viable duplicate of a work of art. And I cannot tell you the number of times I've seen guards stop people saying that they're infringing on the copyright of the museum because,
yeah,
they have a tripod.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, museums do a roaring business in reproductions, don't they? I mean, it's part of the income that they are able to generate.
Some do. I think,
yeah,
most rights and permission employees are going to tell you that the fees they charge to produce these images and send them out is to help defray,
yeah, the
cost
of
providing
of doing
the service.
That, yeah.
And some of them lose money on it every day they stay open. But yes, some of them do a very booming business in licensing rights.
It's interesting that you point out in the book that as we go into an increasingly digital publishing environment, it becomes more easy for collectors and museums to lock down reproductions of public domain material simply by batching them with protected works because of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it needs a lot of retooling.
Yeah.
But the main purpose of that really is, more than anything, to protect databases from being pirated by hackers circumventing security code.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's interesting. Now, in the European Union, one can actually copyright a database, no matter what's in it. This is not yet the case in the United States, but there's certainly, it's up for legislation
pressure
all the
to
time.
Do that, yeah.
So, yes, if you own the only image of a work by Leonardo da Vinci, which has been work in the public domain for 500 years,
yeah,
and you own the only copy, and you batch it together with protected works, you've ostensibly
taken it out of the public
taken
domain.
Taken it out,
yeah,
of the public,
yeah,
domain.
Sure.
You've tied it all up in terms of,
yeah,
access.
Yeah. You know, in general, I wonder how the culture of the Internet is affecting all of this. In some ways, it seems to cultivate the development of a so-called permissions culture where everything is commodifiable and everything has its price. And there are big media interests out there that are scheming as we speak to turn the whole web into something akin to cable and pay-per-view television. But on the other hand, the net paradoxically cultivates an ethos of sharing and the promotion of astonishing experiments in collaborative activity. I wonder, do you have any thoughts about the future of the public domain in a digital world?
Well, yes. I think, as a publisher and as a writer and as someone who works in the art world, I think the key to our cultural and creative future is tied up in the protection and enlargement of the public domain. Recognizing the importance of a public domain just in and of itself is how we cultivate a sense of belonging to a common culture or cultures. And it's the only way in which we can have an unmitigated and open view of history through cultural materials. You know, as the cliche goes, you can't know where you're going until you know where you've been. So creating a robust and always enlarging public domain is, I think, absolutely essential to our creative future. I mean, the beauty of the internet, especially if you want to do internet publishing, is there's a plethora of images online to choose from, and many of them are free. Wikimedia, for example, has an enormous library of public domain artworks to choose from, all of which are fine for online publishing, and many of which are big enough files to use in print media.
In terms of use permissions, do institutions tend to bully publishers about asserting rights to permissions that they don't actually have?
Well, bully is a tough word, but in a word, I mean, what they do is they make it clear that if you don't agree to assert their rights in a work of art, in the caption or whatever, all this is spelled out in the contract. If you don't sign the contract asserting the rights they say they have in a work, then they're not going to give you an image to use. If you need to publish an image, you need to publish an image. Most of us will agree to anything to get an image if there's only one way of getting it.
So generally, publishers tend to cave in.
Well, I would say authors as much as publishers.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about a very complex ecosystem of creativity.
Yeah.
What you're talking about here is a social norm.
There are shades of gray, certainly.
Myriad.
And a lot of grist for lawyers also, if someone wants to bring them into the picture, I expect.
Absolutely.
So what if I go to the MoMA and I take a clandestine shot with my miniature digital camera, say of Jean Arp's Birds in an Aquarium, which I find is out of copyright, and it turns out to be a usable shot for a publication? Do I have to worry about the copyright police coming after me or my publisher because MoMA's visitors policies forbid me from reproducing the photograph without permission?
Well, you know, two questions here. Does MoMA prohibit you from reproducing your photograph?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. On their website, anyway, they explicitly state that you can take photographs, but you're forbidden from reproducing them without permission.
Well, you probably won't have the copyright police coming after you, but you may have MoMA's attorneys coming after you for breach of contract.
Yeah.
When you go into a museum, you're entering into a contract of a certain kind of behavior. You know, you're walking into an institution that, to a certain degree, operates according to its own policies, which may or may not be directly parallel to what rights are provided by statutory law.
Yeah.
Really, the way people, lenders, will say, control images to use or that they own, whether they own the copyright or not, is through contract law. And there's a lot of debate. I mean, this has been ongoing for many, many years. There's a lot of debate about whether one can circumvent statutory law, which might say that a work in the collection of the Metropolitan Museum is 300 years old and therefore its copies are in the public domain. You can use them, I can use them, anyone can use them for whatever purpose because they're in our Commonwealth. But what lenders do is restrict the ways in which you're allowed to use these images through contract. And the debate between contract and statute in many areas of the law is vast, and it's almost biblical. It's just ongoing. And I do think that there needs to be more case law that tests what we call contracts of adhesion. Contracts of adhesion are contracts that perhaps an image bank will insist that you sign before they give you an image.
Yeah.
And if they're indulging in legal overreach, if they're asserting rights to an image that they don't have, and that the only way that you can acquire that image, this might be ascertained to be an inappropriate contract of adhesion by a court.
So what if you make a photograph that includes a work of art in the background, but that isn't primarily a reproduction of that work? You have an interesting anecdote in the book about a case like that.
That's called de minimis use. And it's a very interesting situation. De minimis use means that if you make fleeting use of a work of art, say a painting that appears in the background in a motion picture, or if you're taking a photograph, the primary purpose is to photograph somebody in an art museum or the space of the art museum, and there's in the distance this Picasso that's not the primary subject of the photograph. It's really a case of de minimis use. Now, sometimes, you know, the Picasso estate, they might see it, they might see the photograph, and they might ask you to pay a fee.
Yeah, especially the Picasso estate.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that necessarily you have to, that you are in breach of their copyright law. You know, which brings us to the issue of fair use, if you don't mind me just jumping in.
No, we haven't really talked about it, so.
Because fair use is huge, and is really, you know, in all the different situations we've been talking about here, you know, does contract trump statute? Ultimately, in the United States, there is a thing called the doctrine of fair use. The doctrine of fair use applies only to works that are in copyright. And the doctrine of fair use says that you may own the copyright to the work of art you've created, but under certain circumstances, even without your permission, I can use that work anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very strict guidelines for the situations in which one can appropriate a work by Picasso and use it without getting the Picasso estate's permission.
Well, certainly it's an important thing in libraries and education. I mean, you wouldn't be able to distribute handouts in class without fair use.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You know, we now live in an artistic culture that is so largely based on appropriation.
Yeah.
And fair use says that if you take someone's work and transform it creatively,
mm-hmm.
so that it's your work, it's something new, it's something fresh, it's something original, and it doesn't compete for the market for the original work, then you're probably on safe ground.
Yeah. One thing fair use certainly allows for in the print world is that it allows an author, say a critic, to take an excerpt from another work and incorporate that as a quotation into a text in order to say something about that work. But in the visual world, is it kosher to, say, take an excerpt from a larger work, say a painting, and reproduce a detail to do the same kind of thing? I know there's a question as to whether you can reproduce the whole work to say something about it, but I wonder about if an excerpt is the sort of equivalent of a quotation here.
Well, I suppose it would be. For example, an artist might want to take a leg from a Warhol, and that would be one thing. But very rarely do people just want to publish a part of an image rather than the whole.
Well, that's true, yeah. You need some kind of context. You start the book, interestingly, with a nice sort of non-image of a Francis Bacon work, because the Bacon estate wouldn't allow you to reproduce the image after they read the text that you had accompanying the image.
Well, let's say one thing about fair use.
Mm-hmm.
Fair use is really more of a legal defense than it is an inalienable right.
Yeah.
Whether or not your specific situation of using someone else's work qualifies for fair use is decided in a court of law, not in an editor's office, fundamentally. But, yeah, I mean, that Francis Bacon, probably, if I were writing seriously about that work, critically, specifically about that work, and had to have that work, you know, I might catch hell from the Bacon estate, but I might have a reasonable case of fair use. But I'm using it really in a very trivial way. So there's no real justification for publishing that work without the Bacon estate's permission.
Well, you could use another work, I suppose, to make the same point, but it would have to be a work with the same kind of restriction on it to make that point. I mean, I thought it really did make the point in a way that just talking about it wouldn't, just to have a sort of blank image there with the caption saying the Bacon estate wouldn't allow me to use this image after they read the text.
Well, but all I say about that picture is that the situation in the world today is about as pretty as a Francis Bacon painting, you know.
Yeah.
So
but no,
it's not specific enough.
Yeah, no author would have that kind of control over whether or not you could say something critical about one of his works, though. I mean, it's interesting in that regard, or the author's estate.
Well, they try to exert that.
Yeah.
You know, there are a number of artists and there are a number of estates that want to read what an author is saying about their work before they will give permission to publish the images.
Yeah, for an image, sure.
Yeah.
Now, I'm thinking about a text, though, in this case. You wouldn't find that.
Not unless it's libelous.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So can you talk a bit about the troublesome problem of the copyright orphan? I know it's a thorny problem, and it's a big problem, really exacerbated by the Sonny Bono Extension Act, I think.
Yeah, an orphan work is a work that is probably in copyright, but for whatever reason, we have lost track of who created it, who owns the copyright to it. I mean, there are millions and millions of orphan works. You know, you might find a snapshot in an archive, or you might buy a piece of handmade jewelry at a trunk sale and not know who made it, but you want to publish it for whatever reason in your book. And chances are that work is somehow in copyright, but you have no idea to whom the copyright belongs. So this is created, you know, a terrible burden on scholars and publishers and even people who write for entertainment in terms of how do you track down the owner.
The owner, yeah. And most works in copyright are actually orphans, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, you know, any creative work in a tangible medium qualifies for copyright protection. So this has been a very onerous situation, and publishers and gatekeepers have been very conservative about allowing authors to publish orphan works because in this country, if a copyright holder comes out of the woodwork, they can sue for a remedy. I'm not talking about just, you know, give me $10.
No.
I'm talking about a real lawsuit. And what is going on now federally is that there is legislation that has gone before Congress and been tabled, I should say, that limits the remedies that can be exacted for the use of orphan work should a copyright claimant emerge. No surprise, the reason this has been tabled is largely through the lobbying efforts of organizations of professional photographers and some groups in the entertainment industry.
Yeah. Since art book publishing creates much of the market for museum audiences by creating a public that is familiar with and educated in the visual arts, and since these expensive and restrictive permissions practices, by all accounts, are restricting art publishing by reducing publications lists, killing off publishers, and reducing print runs dramatically, is there any hope that these institutions will come to their senses and start looking at the long term before they kill the goose that lays their golden egg in the name of short-term revenues? And as the public that was raised in the golden age of the art book over the last half of the 20th century comes to be replaced by a generation who won't know a Barbara Hepworth from a hole in the wall.
That's very good. Yes, in fact, institutions are coming to their senses, though it has certainly taken a while. There are a number of initiatives, new initiatives, to make works in museum collections freely or very inexpensively available specifically to scholarly writers and scholarly publishers. I will say that I have mixed feelings about this sort of limitation, but the Metropolitan, for example, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York has joined with the Mellon Foundation Art Store to make a large number of public domain works in the Met's collection available free for copying and publication by scholars.
Yeah.
But you have to be a scholar associated with an institution that can afford the subscription to Art Store. If you're an independent scholar, if you're just Joe Schmo on the street, if you're an independent journalist, or for commercial work, you don't have this kind of benefit.
Yeah, an Art Store is terribly expensive, let me tell you, for a small institution, that's for sure. And I think large institutions pay more than we do.
Exactly. So, and but there is that initiative by the Met. There is a similar one in the UK by the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And the British Museum has agreed to waive licensing fees, which tend to be among the highest on earth, I should mention, for books with very, very small print runs of under 700 copies, which isn't, I mean, there are very few publishers who publish that small a print run, but it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
So these things are, as the debate has heated up, and as writers and scholars have spoken out, and the Academy has spoken out, I would say that a number of institutions are looking at ways to ameliorate the situation.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of attention being paid now, anyway, to the problem of reproduction rights.
Well, they should be. Yeah. We've been jumping up and down about this and screaming long enough, haven't we?
Are there things that scholarly and professional organizations are doing or should be doing to make the system functional again?
Yes, there are a number of things that can be done. And I think one of the most important things that needs to happen is that professional and scholarly organizations need to develop statements and policies of best practices around the exercise of fair use. For example, let me give you an example.
Yeah.
The Society for Cinema and Media Studies in the early to mid-1990s came up with a statement saying that, look, the use of frame captures, of frame stills, absolutely crucial to the work we do.
Yeah.
These are small portions of works that consist of hundreds of thousands of frames. We are going to take those images and publish them without permission as fair use. To my knowledge, ever since they collectively asserted that policy, there's not been a single lawsuit against any of the members in that organization. So other organizations like College Art Association, for example, Modern Language Association, whatever, need to collectively get together and develop these policies and statements of best practices.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's safety in numbers.
Yeah, sure. And best practices do affect case law, the development of case law, I would expect, as things are brought to court. So.
Absolutely.
Now, I just want to mention, you do have a lot of advice in the latter part of your book for authors about to go about finding out what permissions an image requires and for securing these permissions. And actually, there are some rules of thumb that make the process seem not quite as complicated as we're making it seem here, aren't
mm-hmm.
there? Yeah. And also, we almost can't help but characterize the arbiters of copy and reproduction rights as the bad guys in all of this. I mean, the people that hold copyright and reproduction rights, like museums and libraries. But you do make the point in the book that individuals that deal with rights management in most institutions try to do so in good faith and are often just as beleaguered by the Kafkaesque complexities of the permissions purgatory they dwell in as publishers and authors are.
Oh, absolutely.
And in fact, they're often quite good at working the system or helping one to work around it. And often they're the same people that, I mean, the same people often secure rights in these institutions for publications by these institutions as grant rights.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the commerce and a lot of this ecosystem operates through goodwill and social relationships.
Yeah.
So I think it's wrong to jump up and down and say that all museums are bad and all individuals or institutions that own copyright in works of art are bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's called developing a reasonable balance in terms of expectations.
Yeah.
I want to point out that I'm not an attorney, and anything I've said today should not be construed as advice about a specific situation that one really should consult an intellectual property attorney about one's particular situation.
So I want to thank you, Susan, for joining us on the Library Cafe and talking with us about the wild and woolly world of visual arts permissions.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Yeah,
it's always a blast.
Yeah, it has.
Always a blast to talk about this.
It's been fun. So, and your book, I have to say, is really a fun read. Strange to say, because one would think it would be a sort of dry subject.
Well, it is a dry subject, and the challenge in writing that book was how to make it into a subject that would be agreeable to people.
We've been talking with Susan Bielstein, Executive Editor for Art, Architecture, Classical Studies, and Film at the University of Chicago Press, and her new book entitled Permissions, A Survival Guide, Blunt Talk About Art as Intellectual Property, published in 2006 by the University of Chicago Press.